From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The city of Detroit still owns it, but today the state of Michigan begins managing Belle Isle.
Signage will be improved and enhanced. Trails are being cleared, so the overall visitor experience is already on a pathway towards considerable and noticeable enhancement.
Plus, a look at Detroit's stray animal problem and why it matters.
So it's just another marker that things are in disarray and the city isn't doing anything about it.
And passed by the House, two medical marijuana bills grind to a halt in the state Senate.
This bill being championed by medical marijuana advocates, the dispensaries bill, would actually allow local governments to decide whether or not they want dispensaries or provisioning centers.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit's Belle Isle becomes Michigan's 102nd state park. But as the state takes over this historic land, some in Detroit are none too happy. Is this a turning point for Belle Isle, or is it a state takeover? We ask that question later this hour. And then we turn our attention to a package of bills in the state legislature that could drastically change which students do and don't make it past third grade. But first, medical marijuana is legal in Michigan. Voters overwhelmingly said yes to that in 2008. But more than 5 years later, our state still hasn't figured out a good way to get the cannabis into the hands of the more than 100,000 people who are registered as medical marijuana users. In mid-December, two bills were passed by the State House that made it easier for patients to buy medicinal cannabis. House Bill 5104 permits manufacture and sale of non-smoking forms of medical marijuana, capsules, oil, brownies, that could help patients such as pediatric patients who have a hard time smoking the weed. And House Bill 4271 allows communities to decide whether they want dispensaries in their towns. Now, both bills cleared the House with strong bipartisan support, but then it was on to the state Senate, where the reception has been much less enthusiastic. Michigan Public Radio Network Lansing reporter Jake Neer joins us now to pick up the story. Hi, Jake.
How are you doing, Cynthia?
Good. So the bill's got a lot of bipartisan support in the House, and now they're in the hands of the Senate and...
Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville, that's right. It was sort of interesting because when the bills went to the Senate, there was a big question about what committee these bills would be assigned to. You've got Senator Rick Jones is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he's been very much opposed to these kinds of issues in the past. So a lot of people, a lot of medical marijuana advocates were saying, uh-oh, if it goes to his committee, they'll never be taken up. It'll pretty much die right there. So it was kind of a joyous moment for medical marijuana advocates when Randy Richardville decided to refer the bills to his own committee, the Government Operations Committee. But, you know, since then, he's made some comments saying that, well, you know, I don't necessarily support these, and I'm going to sit on them for a while.
And why is that? Why does he want to sit on them for a while when you think that it got, you know, bipartisan quick support in the House? What is it that is making that not happen in Randy Richardville's eyes and on his Government Operations Committee?
Well, you're right. I mean, it was very, very enthusiastic and overwhelming bipartisan support in the House, which made some people think that there was some momentum going forward in the Senate, which honestly, I don't know if that even really exists, momentum for bills. But because as we're seeing right now, it just takes one lawmaker in a position of power to put the kibosh on it. But it seems to me, going back to when we were talking about the pharmaceutical medical marijuana bill that came through the Senate earlier, which was championed by Randy Richardville, and for those who aren't familiar with that, basically it would if the federal government decides to reschedule marijuana as a basically regulated as a prescription drug or legal prescription drug, then pharmacies in Michigan could sell it. That was the bill that was discussed a couple months ago. And passed both chambers. The big concern for Richardville was that the law was passed without really putting a system in place to distribute medical marijuana that was safe. That too many people were growing it and obtaining it just basically for recreational purposes. And he was worried that this would get into the wrong hands. that state-licensed medical marijuana caregivers and patients would somehow, some of them could end up, you know, dealing to children and that kind of thing. So basically, he doesn't think that the system that was put in place has enough regulations, that it's not, you know, controlled enough. So he's worried, I think, that these bills, especially the provisioning center or dispensaries bill, would just strengthen a system that according to him and some people have called kind of a wild, wild west thing. So that's sort of his mentality.
Jake, what are we hearing from others in the Senate? Are they lining up with Richardville, or are there senators who want to go ahead and get these things passed?
Well, you know, I mean, the Senate is much more heavily controlled by Republicans than the House. But at the same time, you'd have to think that with the amount of support in the House from Republicans for these bills, that the Senate Republicans can't be all that different, right? But at the same time, you know, there are some very, very vocal opponents of medical marijuana in the system that's in place in the Senate. I think that this would be a pretty interesting battle if it came up for a vote on the floor of the Senate. I have a feeling that, you know, things might be a little bit different, but it's really hard to tell at this point just because there's been so little. I mean, if you look at the process in the House, it took months and months to, you know, get people on board. And so basically they're starting the process all over again in the Senate. And so it's really hard to tell what the support is like at this point.
Jacobs, as we know, last Thursday, the Michigan Supreme Court ruled against the city of Wyoming outside Grand Rapids, saying that local laws cannot preempt the state's medical marijuana laws. What do you think this ruling might mean to particularly this House Bill 4271, the dispensaries bill? Would it have an impact that you could envision?
You know, I don't see it. And not being a legal scholar myself, I don't know exactly whether or not it would have any influence. But just on the surface, it does not seem like this would have any dramatic effect on that Supreme Court ruling or on the bill. But it is sort of interesting that the Supreme Court, which is known for being a little more conservative and a little more, you know, anti-medical marijuana in some ways, has come out and basically said that has taken control away from local governments, saying that the medical marijuana law trumps their local ordinances. But this bill being championed by medical marijuana advocates, the dispensaries bill, would actually allow local governments to decide whether or not they want dispensaries or provisioning centers, you know, and how they would want to regulate that. So it's an interesting sort of divergence in what you'd expect, in terms of wanting local governments, giving them control over the situation.
This has to be tough, and I bet you've heard from patients or parents of pediatric patients who thought they might be close to getting these two bills through the legislature. So if you want to see this happen, this has to be pretty frustrating.
I think there is a certain level of frustration. But at the same time, I think if you look at what happened in the House, the chair of the Judiciary Committee over there, Kevin Cotter, expressed similar frustrations the Senate Majority Leader is expressing right now. It seemed like he wasn't on board with this. But then after lobbyists for medical marijuana advocates really had a chance to educate him on the bills and talk to him about what they would really do, he came around and really championed these bills in the House. So anything can happen from this point. So I think basically again, like I said, they're really starting the process all over in the Senate, it seems like. But anything can happen. Although, again, this is an election year, and these controversial questions are often not resolved until after the election. So if we don't see anything move anytime soon, I wouldn't be surprised to see this as a lame duck issue after the November elections.
Much like we saw Right to Work. Let's jam it through in lame duck, and then we go home.
Right to Work and so many other bills last year.
Indeed. Jake Neer, Michigan Public Radio Network Lansing reporter. Thanks so much, Jake.
Thanks, Cindy.
Ford and General Motors both recently decided to stop producing cars in Australia. Well, now that country's car manufacturing industry is about to reach the literal end of the road. Following today's announcement that Toyota will close operations there as well. Stateside's partner, the BBC, has more. This from business correspondent Russell Padmore.
Toyota has been building cars in Australia since 1963, but from the end of 2017, models like the popular Camry will have to be imported, as they'll be built elsewhere. The Japanese firm's decision to close its operation means the loss of about 2,500 jobs. Max Yasuda is the president of Toyota's Australian arm.
Let me assure you that this has been an extremely difficult decision to make. It is not viable to continue manufacturing in Australia.
It follows similar moves by General Motors, which will close its Australian manufacturing operation within 4 years, and Ford, which plans to exit the country within 2 years. Toyota's Japanese rival Mitsubishi closed its plant in Adelaide 5 years ago. Australia's car industry has suffered from rising production costs and the appreciation of the Aussie dollar, which has gained nearly 50% against the US dollar since 2009. Locally made vehicles are uncompetitive against cheaper imports. Professor David Bailey from Aston Business School is an expert in the car industry.
Australia's an expensive place to make cars. Labour costs four times those in China or Thailand, and it's a small market. The best-selling car probably only sells 40,000 cars a year. It's not attractive anymore to the big producers.
Australia's car industry produced about 178,000 vehicles a year and had survived with subsidies from the government. However, Toyota did not approach Canberra for financial assistance. Over the last 11 years, Holden, the Australian arm of General Motors, has received about $1.6 billion from the government. The Australian Manufacturing Workers Union described the end of automotive production in the country as simply heartbreaking.
And that report from BBC business correspondent Russell Padmore. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is a two-bill package making its way through the state legislature that could impact students in every third-grade classroom in Michigan. The bill would hold back third graders with poor reading skills. So if a child fails a third grade reading exam, he or she would not move along to fourth grade. Now, backers say it can help get a struggling student back on track. Critics say flunking a struggling student is a punishment. And State School Superintendent Mike Flanagan panned the legislation. He says it should be up to local schools and to parents. Amber Arellano is the executive director of the Education Trust Midwest. Hello, Amber.
Hi, Cindy.
So before we get into the Michigan bills, I'm wondering what your views are on the Florida law, the retention law that's been in place about 10 years now. And do you feel it effectively helps kids who can't read well enough in the third grade?
Yeah, Florida did adopt a test-based promotion policy based on third grade proficiency, but it did so alongside tens of millions of dollars in strategic investments and strategies that help boost literacy rates among all grades, but particularly for early grades for Florida students. So the accountability piece really came after that they had begun to really put these new systems in place. And, you know, to Florida's credit, they really have seen dramatic improvement in literacy rates, particularly among low-income and African-American and Latino students.
Is this kind of, over the 10 years, have they been able to track a long-term improvement?
They have. If you look at the data from their proficiency rates, even on based on national standards, based on the national assessment, they have made dramatic gains in student learning for students really across the board over the last decade.
So how does Michigan's package of bills compare to what Florida has, for better or for worse?
They're radically different. Right now, Michigan is simply focusing on accountability, and we really worry that it's really holding kids accountable for the work that the adults in the system, and really we Michiganders, that we, you know, that when we're not providing them a quality education, particularly in their early years, and the supports that they need to learn how to read by third grade, then really it's our responsibility to make sure that they get that kind of support and better teaching rather than holding them accountable for what schools aren't giving them.
So I think what I'm hearing is, unlike Florida that had the accountability, but before that they put the money in place for programs and help in reading, this would not happen in the way the bills are in Michigan.
That's right. In Florida, they did a variety of strategies. So they developed a new statewide teacher and principal support and training and evaluation system so that if students were held back, retained students wouldn't be simply passed on to another struggling teacher who may or may not be really strong at teaching literacy skills to K-3 students. They also adopted and invested in really significant training. This was not just for early grades. They actually invested in retraining all of their teachers, K-12, and spent millions of dollars in helping them become better instructors of literacy. They also invested money in summer programs, reading programs, to help kids that were behind. And then they also did a strategy to ensure that kids who were falling behind would actually get better teachers, so that if they were falling behind, they would be placed with a teacher that was more experienced or more effective at teaching literacy skills in those early grades. So all of those strategies combined had a really profound impact on literacy rates. And then, you know, after all of those systems were put into place, then they said, okay, if kids are still behind, then perhaps they need more time, and we need to hold them back for a year to give them more time to catch up.
So it I think I'm hearing between the lines that Michigan's bills, as they exist now, would perhaps be destined to fail if state lawmakers don't put some money where their collective mouths are.
Well, not only fail, but really, I mean, I think the potential here is to actually harm students more than help them. What the research has shown that by holding a child back, they're more likely to drop out, and that oftentimes these kinds of strategies unfairly target particular groups of students, so specifically African American and Latino students, who, as we know, are often in schools that are low performing and not serving them very well.
Do we have a sense of what it would cost Michigan to hold youngsters back? Has anyone been able to crunch those kind of numbers? And I'm wondering how that would compare to putting that money into intervention programs to find and help these struggling readers before they get to that third grade evaluation.
Yeah, so we have done that. Just for retention alone, we, based on this school year, we estimated a cost of $500 million just to hold students back and give them an additional year of teaching. You know, we worry, too, that the numbers of students that this would apply to will skyrocket next year. We're adapting higher standards, and we're adopting a new assessment next school year. And based on the new higher standards, we're estimating about 80,000 third graders in Michigan would be retained next year.
What percentage is that? What are we looking at?
That's about 69%.
That's mind-boggling.
It is. I mean, when you think about it, I think a lot of people think, well, this law would only apply to very, very low-income or struggling students, and it would be a small percentage of our state. Well, the truth is that it will apply for really to many, many middle-class students, many suburban schools, rural schools. I mean, this would be the majority of the students in Michigan. So the timing of this is also really problematic. We would like to see the state take that money instead and begin investing it in what we know are really strategic investments and boosting student learning, particularly in the early grades.
So what do you think the takeaway for this, and maybe what parents who care about this should be doing right now?
I think certainly parents should be reaching out to lawmakers to talk with them about their thoughts on this. I think it's important for policymakers to know that the number of students that this will impact if these bills go through will skyrocket next year when we're adopting higher standards. And we need to do that. We really have had low standards in Michigan for a long time, and it's not given parents a very honest idea of how their students are really performing or how schools are really serving our kids. So, you know, the way forward is not to say, let's not raise our standards. The way forward is to say, let's do that. Let's invest in our teachers, help them make the transition to teaching in this at higher levels and deeper ways to help our kids boost literacy rates and help them do better compared to the rest of the world. And maybe right now we ought to think thoughtfully about how this may impact kids, and if this is really the right time for these particular bills.
Amber Arellano is the executive director of the Education Trust Midwest. It has been great to talk to you. Thank you so much, Amber.
Thank you.
And in other education news, Saginaw School Board members meet again tomorrow to discuss how to deal with that district's multi-million-dollar deficit. The school board has met three times in the past week alone, trying to hash out a deficit elimination plan. The most recent proposal called for laying off employees and closing three schools, including Saginaw High School. Parents and teachers attacked the plan, and they attacked the board for even considering it. Late last week, the State Department of Education agreed to give the district more time to come up with an acceptable deficit elimination plan. Without a new plan, the state's threatening to withhold Saginaw's February state aid payment. Picture yourself coming home at the end of the day. Do you walk through the door, hang up your coat, and sit down in your living room, maybe grab a snack and turn on the TV? But what if, rather than walking into your warm, comfortable house, you came home to a tent? Brian Durrance is the president of Mission A2. It's an organization that has maintained rotating tent cities for the homeless in Ann Arbor. He challenges us to rethink our definition of home, and he believes community is crucial for people to regain stability in their lives. Well, now Mission A2 is building a permanent shelter and an outdoor camp for people without homes, and they're calling it Homeward Bound.
Yeah, we bought a house, and this house has 3 acres of wooded land right in the city of Ann Arbor. The first phase is the house itself. We're going to be renovating the house and welcoming people to come there for daytime services such as laundry, showers, and perhaps internet services. We also hold meals there every Sunday. And this is where the community and the community supporters gather to discuss the needs of people who are living outside.
Now, you're saying that right now the house is kind of come during the day, come for a meal on a Sunday. You can come and kind of shower and maybe get on the internet and work on a job search during the day. But people aren't sleeping at the house at this point, no?
That's right. But we have a bigger vision. That's phase two. We are hoping to build a community on the wooded part of the property behind the house eventually. And it will start off, hopefully, as a tent city, but it will evolve into a tiny house community. And this is a new trend that people are seeing all over the country.
So the idea, Brian, that this is a permanent thing, you've bought the house, you've bought the 3 acres. First of all, to the homeless people that come, the campers, the people who had been camping, what does that mean in terms of a mindset of something being permanent as opposed to rotating?
What it says to people who are homeless is that there's a permanent home base. We are working with the existing shelter system, and the way we're helping them is to feed people who are waiting for services into the system. So people who are homeless need a place to come and seek respite. And the idea is that the house should feel like a home. When you come here, it's not an institutional setting. It's a home. It's a living room, a place where you can cook, a place where you can relax. And they rebuild their confidence, and then they're able to go out. And with the assistance of people in the community, they plug into the services so they can get to a place of self-sufficiency. What we find is that people come to us very beaten down, alienated. And what we find is that as people's confidence is restored, they reach out to the people who they've lost contact with, such as, you know, spouses, parents. A lot of them restore their relationships with grown children, which is very exciting. And eventually, they begin to think of themselves as being full members of society again and start trying to take the steps to get themselves back on track.
So we've talked about how the homeless folks feel about having this permanent settlement. How is it being received by the neighborhood?
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. We just met with members of the local community. They have a community center out there, the Bryant Community Center. And we are already participating in their neighborhood food distribution program. I mean, I think it was kind of fun when we were there for their meeting. They welcomed us and they said, you know, you're now part of our neighborhood.
You talked about these tiny home communities, and they're popping up around the country. Does that say something about the way society views homeless people, that they need to have a patch, they need to have something, whether it's 20 by 20, that society is comfortable when somebody is sleeping in this little tiny house?
I think it is. It's certainly true that people would prefer to see homeless people living indoors, whether it's in a tiny house or whether it's in an apartment. People have a very visceral reaction to people living out of doors. And we feel that there is something quite valuable that comes out of living in a tent. When you move into a tent, you are taking control of your environment, and you have to do it cooperatively, because the knowledge that you seek is held by people that live in the tent community with you. So in exchanging knowledge, sharing what you've learned with someone else, people grow. They get stronger. So we're very excited about the tent city model, and we're also excited about the tiny house model, but we see it as a second stage in someone's growth.
What's behind that visceral response that you see from the public when they see somebody living on a sidewalk?
Many people say that in America, it is unacceptable for people to live out of doors. And particularly because Michigan has such a harsh climate, we find the tent city to be a tough sell. So as I've said, there are many advantages to living in a tent. But we ourselves see it as a transitional form of housing.
We're speaking with Brian Durance, the president of Mission A2. And Brian, you talked about that visceral response in members of the public and how many people feel it's just wrong to have someone sleeping outside or sleeping in a tent. A lot of people think getting them into the house will fix the problem. But in your work with the homeless, you found putting them in a house doesn't necessarily solve the problem of why they're homeless?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I guess the elephant in the room is that the cause of homelessness, chronic homelessness, mm-hmm. is disability. And that disability could be physical disability, but there's also a mental disability, such mm-hmm. as schizophrenia, bipolar depression, other complicated anxiety disorders, and many people are dually and even triply diagnosed mm-hmm. with these mental disorders. And some of them are treatable, and some of them are only partially treatable. So what you find are people that really would like to be self-sufficient, but are constantly hamstrung. And so we have found that putting someone in a house only partially solves the problem. And people often, you'll find, have for years self-medicated with drugs and alcohol. So our first task is to try to get them into a place where they are feeling confident. And we find that happens only in community. One of the things that we feel it's different is that if the homeful and the homeless come together as partners and both take ownership in the process, that's where the magic is. So the therapy is not only for the people who are living outside, but it's also for the people who are coming to help. And when we join together as a community, we both benefit.
Mission A2 hopes to raise $850,000 to renovate the house and develop the land at Homeward Bound. They welcome community volunteers, especially looking for experts to help them in their work with City Council. For information, just go to missiona2.org. We've been talking to Brian Durance, the president of Mission A2, Michigan Itinerant Shelter System Interdependent Out of Necessity. Thank you so much for joining us, Brian.
Thank you, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A new chapter in the long history of Detroit's Belle Isle began today as it became Michigan's 102nd state park. It's been transitioning for a while, but the full change kicked in today as state parks officials assumed control of the island. It all happens under the lease imposed by Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr. It's figured this move will save the city between $4 and $6 million a year. And beginning today, motorists will need the $11 state recreation passport to enter the park. So what does this mean for Belle Isle and for the city of Detroit? We turn to Detroit Free Press editorial page editor Stephen Henderson. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we welcome Michelle Hodges. She's president of the Belle Isle Conservancy, and she chairs the newly formed Belle Isle Advisory Committee. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, Cynthia. It's great to be here on this milestone day.
It is. There was such a long journey, Michelle, before we could actually say those words. The state DNR officially takes over management of Belle Isle today. What are your thoughts and feelings as this moment is finally here?
Well, you were right when you referred to it as a new chapter. And the good news is that we're empowered as the Belle Isle Conservancy and as the Belle Isle State Park Advisory Committee to ensure that it is exactly that, that we are able to take advantage of the buoyancy that I think we're all feeling in Detroit and ensure that Belle Isle be an essential part of that. We will be ardent advocates for the park, and I can tell you my experience with this transition period has been exceptional. They're in this for the right reasons. Their intentions are good. And by working together and having the check and balance of this advisory committee, we can ensure that we can continue on that trajectory forward.
You know, Stephen, when this idea of turning Belle Isle into a state park first surfaced, there were so many in city and community leadership roles who voiced such strong opposition to, the quote we often heard was handing over one of Detroit's jewels to the state. Now, recognizing that this arrangement has the state holding this long-term lease to run the park and Belle Isle is still owned by the city, Stephen, what do you think most Detroiters feel about this arrangement now that it's reality?
Well, I mean, I think the poll that was done last year gave us a really clear picture of what actual Detroiters, you know, people who live here, think about it. And it was, you know, it wasn't close. It was something like 60-65% of them said, look, go ahead and let the state run it. What they really care about is the island and the condition of the island and their enjoyment of the island. I mean, anybody who's been here for any number of decades, you know, as I have, I mean, having grown up here in the 70s and 80s, can remember when it was a much better place and in much better shape. There was more programming. The grass was cut more frequently. You know, it's really fallen into pretty bad disrepair because the city can't afford to maintain it. And so the idea of ownership, I think it takes a back seat in most people's minds to the utility. You know, what does Belle Isle give us? What does it offer us? And I think it's going to be more with the state handling it.
What have we seen, Michelle, so far since the transition began? What physically has been happening on the island?
There are measured results already. Restrooms are being reopened, picnic tables being repaired, roofs being repaired, trash receptacles anchored, signage will be improved and enhanced, trails are being cleared. So the overall visitor experience is already on a pathway towards considerable and noticeable enhancement. And we're not, today marks the first official day. So I think that's a testimony to what we can expect going forward. And I certainly know I give my personal pledge to this community to be the insurance that it needs to know that this is going to be a very robust, equitable partnership, and that if need be, we'll be that elegant pit bull that, you know, needs to take measures to ensure that that happens. But again, given the results we've already seen, I think the potential for that is extremely limited.
So you don't expect to have to be the elegant pit bull?
No, I don't at all.
Now, the Free Press recently reported there was the first meeting of the Citizens Advisory Committee, and Stephen, there was a report on some concerns by members that the state police and the state park rangers who will be patrolling Belle Isle, replacing the Detroit Police Department, might not understand the culture of Detroiters. What specifically were their concerns?
Well, I think there's always a concern when you have, you know, folks from outside Detroit policing Detroiters. There's some cultural barriers there, then historical issues that I think pop into people's minds. You know, but I'd make a couple points. Number one, state police patrol every state park in Michigan. And, you know, Detroiters go to state parks all the time. I mean, this is not creating something measurably different than what we already have in other places. So, I mean, I think the fear of, you know, this being some sort of anomaly may be somewhat overblown. You know, at the same time, Belle Isle has its own sort of tempo and pace. I mean, Michelle can attest to this too. You know, we both spend a lot of time out on that island, and it is different because it's in the city, and you've got to be sensitive to that. I mean, the people have got to be able to enjoy themselves there without fear that the police will crack down on behavior that's not illegal. I really don't have a lot of concern about that, like I said.
We hear those concerns as a committee as well, and we have a duty to take those seriously. And I think that the committee, even at its first meeting, was already beginning to effectively fulfill its role. You know, Reverend Peake addressed that matter and, you know, very eloquently noted that
what we or some of the law enforcement personnel may see as rowdy or troublemaking is actually defined as fun and really has no threat tied to it. So I think that those are the issues. If we can use those as opportunities to constructively dialogue about them and constructively identify solutions, we're going to avoid those pitfalls that we hit so frequently as a community and get to a higher degree of function if we're very capable and astute in how we manage that process and get a decision-making framework incorporated into it so that residents feel engaged, they feel touched, they feel included, they feel part of it. And then we're going to avoid that. Are we going to have a bump in the road? Probably. But I can assure you we're going to do everything we can to handle it in a way that moves us forward rather than backward.
Hey, Stephen, what can you tell us about this story emerging about Hong Kong investor Jimmy Lai and being interested in rescuing the Detroit Boat Club?
You know, I've heard a little about that here and there. I think what that reflects is this new international interest in property in Detroit. We're seeing some of that downtown right now with Chinese investors buying up some buildings. You know, that's a good thing, right? The boat club has sat there neglected for I think 15 or 20 years now.
Easily.
And it's used by a rowing club that operates on the river. But, you know, they're not able to keep that building up the way that it should. And, you know, it needs to be fixed.
And it says Belle Isle may be a state park, but it's still open for investment.
Well, I think places like the boat clubs clearly are.
Yes.
And, you know, I think, you know, I'm not sure you want to privatize any other parts of it. I mean, that's a pretty sensitive issue. It's a public park. I mean, the idea of Belle Isle always was to give access to recreation to Detroiters. It ought to stay that way.
But it is interesting to realize that a major investor is looking at really what is a very badly decaying building and seeing great possibility, which I guess to all of those folks who care about our cities, it tells us something about the blighted buildings not only in Detroit but throughout Michigan cities. Yes, there is possibility.
There is a master plan that's been created, and you know that gives us a decision-making framework at this early stage that we need to mature as we go forward. And there are guiding principles in there, and the boat club, boathouse in and of itself is identified as an opportunity for marine amenities, as a conference space, as you know potentially housing a restaurant and the like. So you know we have to go through the intellectual process of vetting these projects. One concern the Conservancy has, and concern probably isn't the right word, we just know it's something that needs to be vetted further in light of needing to find the balance with smart economic development, because we do need private sector investment. You know, we need to look at the fact that this developer is proposing to tear the building down. So that is something that I think the communities is going to want to have a say in. So we're going to have to manage that dialogue.
How about the aquarium? What are you hearing, and what changes might we expect to see in the aquarium?
Well, the aquarium is one of the crown jewels of the Belle Isle Conservancy's resume. We have this amazing legion of volunteers that manage and operate that aquarium. They've reopened it one day a week. We're looking at expanding those hours. We've signed agreements with Wayne State University to operate a field office there and to install a research lab, which we think is really the essence of the future of that aquarium. It's a pathway to national sources of funding. It's a very important cultural asset on the island. That same legion of volunteers just did a mission to the National Aquarium in Washington, D.C. to bring back a lot of the equipment and products and materials from there that unfortunately is closing. So Detroiters are going to benefit from that. So we see the aquarium as a very important opportunity going forward. And Pure Detroit has joined that team. Just this past weekend, we launched the opening of a Pure Detroit gift shop, the Island Outpost, as we're referring to it. So that's a great way to earn a revenue stream and also engage our supporters by giving them opportunities to purchase Belle Isle-related materials. So it's really a win-win opportunity.
Yeah, sitting here listening to Michelle, I mean, I'm sort of reminded of the context in which this all happens. I mean, the Conservancy is really pushing forward with some important initiatives on that island already, right? And so now you have the state adding its shoulder to that weight forward. But this all dovetails pretty importantly, I think, with the work that the Riverfront Conservancy has been doing for the last 10 years, all the way, you know, as they say, from bridge to bridge, from the Ambassador up to the Belle Isle Bridge, creating more of a public park space along our waterfront. And so this comes along at a time when we're really ready to connect all those pieces of, together so that we do have the kind of waterfront community that we should, given the water frontage that we have. I mean, this was all industrial when I was a kid, and Belle Isle was the only place for that kind of recreation. Now Belle Isle will be part of this magnificent stretch of waterfront amenities, including Milliken State Park, which is just down the river from them. So, I mean, this is really taking a step, big step forward in the way that we think of recreation and think of waterfront access in Detroit.
Michelle Hodges, president of the Belle Isle Conservancy and also chair of the newly formed Belle Isle Advisory Committee and Detroit Free Press editorial page editor and lifelong Detroiter Stephen Henderson. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So Belle Isle is now Michigan's 102nd state park. But what about our first state park? Any guesses? Well, those of you up north may know the answer. Michigan's very first state park was Interlochen State Park, about 15 miles outside Traverse City. The park was established by the Michigan legislature in 1917, and the state paid $60,000 for the land. Okay, let's head back to Detroit now, where the question of stray animals in the city has been in the spotlight ever since Bloomberg News put out a story that painted Detroit as some post-apocalyptic place where, and here's a quote, abandoned dogs roam in packs as humans dwindled. And another quote made worldwide news saying, as many as 50,000 stray dogs roam the streets and vacant homes of bankrupt Detroit. Well, I'm joined now by someone with a different view of the stray animal problem in Detroit. Michigan State University political science professor Laura Rees has completed the first academic study of the stray animal problem. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you.
What does a stray animal problem, Laura, anywhere mean to that community? I mean, clearly there's the public health concerns. We'll start with the obvious animal bites and the like. But what deeper issues does it mean?
I think there's a couple things. One is that just like abandoned buildings or, you know, broken windows, you know, selling drugs on the street, having roaming animals is a marker of disorder in the community. For the residents of the community, it can hurt their efficacy to do something about bettering their community. So it's just another marker that things are in disarray and the city isn't doing anything about it.
So your study pegs the number of stray cats and dogs in Detroit at about how many?
The most common answer in my study for dogs was about 10,000. The mean answer was about 7,500. For cats, it's more and probably more around 15,000 to 17,000. Mm-hmm. But a couple things are important here. I mean, first of all, I didn't do a count.
You weren't in the field.
Right. I was not in the field standing on the street corner counting dogs and cats. So I was asking people from animal welfare organizations that are in the trenches in the city how big they think the problem is. So, for instance, on the dogs, I got answers that ranged from zero, which is crazy, to 50,000. So there is quite a considerable range of opinion about how many dogs and cats are out there.
And what do you hope will happen with this research? What do you think could come from the data you've gathered?
I'd like to look for ways for the city to better work with the nonprofit groups and for the nonprofit groups to more efficiently and effectively work with each other on coming up with solutions to the problem. And then I'd also just like more awareness in the community about what individuals can do. You know, it's not just a city problem or a group problem. There's a lot of things that people can do as far as donating their time as a volunteer and particularly providing foster homes for animals. That's one of the biggest needs that the animal rescue groups identified. And, you know, just about anybody can do that.
In the reader comments in the Detroit News, following the Detroit News report on your study, There was a distinct strain of, well, that figures, it's Detroit. We take care of our animals. There was a lot of that. Did that bother you?
It does bother me. What do you expect people to do? Detroit has had a tremendous foreclosure crisis. And when people are put out of their homes and have to go into apartments or homeless shelters, in the worst case, their animals have to go somewhere. So you have just so much economic dislocation in the city that, of course, you're going to have these issues. And people don't have the money for their own health care, let alone for spay and neuter for animals. I mean, it's just, it really is what you would expect to see from an economic crisis of the magnitude of Detroit's.
MSU political science professor Laura Reese, her study was the first academic study of the problem of stray animals in the city of Detroit. Laura, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And before we end today's program, some more news out of Detroit. The city says it will file a plan to emerge from bankruptcy next week, just days before a March 1st deadline. The disclosure was made during a hearing on the case this morning. The city recently shared a reorganization plan with creditors, although that plan is subject to change while negotiations continue in private. And you can, of course, find all our continuing coverage on the city and bankruptcy proceedings online. Just go to michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and Claire Tenniskitter. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.